This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. On today's program, calls for calm in Central Australia as tensions between Indigenous communities and police hit a new low after the shooting death of 19-year-old Kumanjar Walker. And in the West, Carnarvon mourners appeal to police to step back as they prepare to bury another police shooting victim.
Now, fill this town with police, stuff like that, that's just totally stupid, you know. You just got to stand back, let the funeral happen, and hopefully that's it. Because if the police are going to drive past the churches or the cemeteries, it's just going to be provocation.
It's been revealed for a whole week security agencies monitored the hack of the Federal Parliamentary IT system before shutting it down and resetting the passwords of its thousands of users. The private data of two senators and an unknown number of lower house members of parliament was stolen during the cyber raid, but the government's been cagey about providing further details, citing security. But AM can reveal another attempted hack just a fortnight ago. Here's political reporter Tom Eagledon.
The simple click of a mouse punctured a hole in the digital wall meant to protect one of the most sensitive IT systems imaginable. Senate President Scott Ryan told a parliamentary committee a little of how it happened.
A small number of users visited a legitimate external website that had been compromised. This caused malware to be injected into the parliamentary computing network.
Security agencies noticed the breach on January 31 this year. For 8 days, they watched and waited until on February the 8th, they shut the system down. Two senators and a small number of lower house MPs had their data stolen during the hack.
I called the two senators.
Yep.
I telephoned. It was before that. I believe that statement. It was the day before.
But that's as much as the government's giving away, despite the best efforts of Labor Senator Kimberly Kitching.
What happened between the 31st of January and the 8th of February?
I have to say that given this forum, I am unable to go into any further detail.
The government's previously acknowledged a sophisticated state actor directed the hack. Centre Alliance Senator Rex Patrick says much more needs to be made public.
The problem is we do not know how long this Foreign Intelligence Service was monitoring or indeed looking inside the parliamentary system prior to the 31st of January. It's an open secret that the Australian Signals Directorate identified the Chinese Ministry of State Security as the Foreign Intelligence Agency responsible. In my view, there should be transparency about who they think did this.
The government's also refusing to say what the malware-ridden website was and who clicked on it.
Yeah, we don't understand whether it was parliamentarians or not.
And AM can reveal that just a fortnight ago, another hack was attempted, with users on the parliamentary system notified by email.
In recent weeks, you may have seen reports of Emotet Trojan malware that has affected Queensland and South Australian health systems. Over the last few days, our parliamentary system has been targeted with the same malware.
The email asks users to stop accessing personal email accounts, such as Gmail, from their parliamentary devices.
Our Cyber Security Operations Centre has observed that users are now being targeted individually through personal webmail accounts in an attempt to circumvent our corporate controls and launch the malware into our network.
Shadow Assistant Cyber Security Minister Tim Watts says it's clear not enough parliamentarians or their staff are taking security seriously, despite the efforts of the Department of Parliamentary Services.
I've attended these cyber hygiene training courses for DPS, and there are very few other MPs in them. I think that the political class in Australia needs to get the wake-up call that they are targets.
And that's Shadow Assistant Cybersecurity Minister Tim Watts ending Tom Eagledon's report. The Dutch-led team investigating the downing of MH17 has released new phone intercepts showing the links between pro-Russian rebels in eastern Ukraine and top Kremlin officials. The rebels are accused of launching the missile that took down the Malaysian Airlines flight that killed 298 people, including 38 Australians, over eastern Ukraine 5 years ago. The announcement suggests that Russian officials had greater control over the separatist forces than first thought. Is Europe correspondent Bridget Brennan.
Добрый день, Александр.
Да, добрый.
This is Alexander Borodai, a former separatist leader of the Donetsk People's Republic, saying he's carrying out orders and protecting the interests of the one and only state, the Russian Federation. It was made less than 2 weeks before MH17 was shot out of the sky in eastern Ukraine. A Dutch-led task force says phone taps show regular communication between rebel fighters and Russian officials in the first half of July 2014. Andy Craig is the head of the Central Criminal Investigation Division of Dutch Police.
Recent analysis of witness statements and other information revealed that Russian influence on the DPR went further than military support. Ties between Russian officials and DPR leaders appear to have been much closer.
In May last year, the joint investigation team announced a Russian missile was used to bring down the Malaysian Airlines plane, killing 298 people, including 38 Australians. Now, investigators believe these new recordings could point to the Russian government's involvement in the tragedy. Andy Craig again.
The indications for close ties between Russian government officials and leaders of the DPR raise questions about their possible involvement in the deployment of the Buck Taylor, which brought down flight MH17 on 17 July 2014.
David Nelson is a senior investigations officer for the Australian Federal Police.
In addition to regular telephones, the rebels used secure means of communication. A number of these seem to be provided by the Russian Federation and, moreover, used by Russian top officials in their contact with the fighters.
Other intercepts include conversations between a political aide to Vladimir Putin, Vladislav Surkov, and Mr. Borodai. In one of the calls, Mr. Surkov allegedly tells Mr. Borodai that there will be reinforcements coming from Russia. Russian officials have questioned the authenticity of the tapes. Earlier this year, the Joint Investigations Team charged four men, three Russians and one Ukrainian, over their role in the downing of MH17. They're expected to go on trial in absentia in a Dutch court in March next year.
It's Bridget Brennan reporting there. After 2,269 days, or just over 6 years on Manus Island, refugee and author Bruce Buchani is in New Zealand this morning. Perhaps it's not surprising he's vowed never to return to PNG. Mr. Buchani was sent to Manus Island as part of Australia's offshore processing policy. He's travelled to Christchurch to speak at a literary event, and he says he's considering applying for asylum there. David Sparks reports.
Iranian asylum seeker Behrouz Buchani stepped off the plane in New Zealand last night looking exhausted but very happy. And his supporters were thrilled.
Hello, sir. So good to see you.
After his six-year ordeal in Papua New Guinea, no one there begrudged his very human impulse once his feet hit the ground.
I think I should have a smoke first. I don't know.
I think that's a good idea.
Yeah. So later we can talk about this, but of course it is a great moment.
Behrouz Buchani received a visitor's visa to travel to Christchurch to speak at a literary event about his award-winning book, No Friend But the Mountains. He first had to receive temporary travel documents and permission from the PNG Immigration Department. And he says he's proud to have survived immigration detention.
You know, for years we look at Australia as a New Zealand, as a hope. But this hope was sometimes was very close, but we couldn't touch it, you know.
The refugee famously typed his book in a series of WhatsApp messages while in detention on Manus Island. It was an account of his often dangerous journey to Christmas Island and his subsequent incarceration on Manus. He's considering applying for asylum in New Zealand, but another possibility is to travel to the United States, where he was recently accepted for resettlement. Amnesty International's Tim O'Connor has known Mr. Buchani since 2013.
Behrouz is finally free of Australia's detention regime. He was sent there, of course, when he sought asylum. He sought safety from Iran, where he was being persecuted. But unfortunately, he was sent to Manus and he spent 7 years there in torment. And this morning, you know, as Behrouz says, he's finally feels like a free man.
Behrouz Buchani is obviously a very talented and hardworking journalist and writer. What do you think the future might hold for him?
I mean, the future for Behrouz is limitless. You know, he's as you know, he was saying to me, he's overcome the impression of Australia, the billions of dollars that have been spent to stifle his voice, and he's found a voice of millions and millions of people around the world. You know, Beirut's future is very bright, and it's much brighter today than it has been certainly for the last 7 years.
That's Amnesty International's Tim O'Connor ending that report by David Sparks. In the Northern Territory, residents of the remote community of Yuendumu want police banned from carrying guns in their town. It follows the shooting death of 19-year-old Kumanjai Walker on Saturday night. Last night, the Federal Minister for Indigenous Australians, Ken Wyatt, flew to Alice Springs to hear the community's concerns. Indigenous Affairs correspondent Isabella Higgins was there.
The Alice Springs showground has been transformed into a small village. Dozens of residents from Yuendumu have set up camp, using it as a base while they protest against the death of their own. Last night they had a special guest, the Indigenous Affairs Minister Ken Wyatt, and Senior Walpiri Elder Ned Hargraves wasted no time telling him their concerns.
We do not want rifles in Yuendumu as from now.
The death in custody of Kumanjai Walker has led to protests around the country, prompting the minister to fly into Alice Springs to meet with the community. Ned Hargraves wants guns banned in Yuendumu, and that includes firearms carried by police.
Policemen wearing rifles in remote communities. We're not in the city over there. We're in the desert. In Yuendumu, when they were good policemen, they never wore that gun.
It's a sentiment echoed by others in the community. This man, who wanted to be known only as Cedric, says the presence of guns in the community sends the wrong message to young people.
Kids were frightened from police. They ran away from the police. All the kids said, policemen, policemen, they're going to shoot us. Run away, run away. All the kids saying that, yeah, that's really sad.
Elder Harry Nelson agrees. He says distrust in the community is growing.
Guns should be only be warned when it is some kind of problem in the community. And that's where my main concern is, frightening children. That's frightening.
The federal minister has offered to work with the community, but says policing and their use of guns is an issue for the territory government to address. Local independent member Scott McConnell was also at last night's meeting. He says he'll take the matter up with the chief minister.
I think it is absolutely inappropriate for police to be armed the way they are in remote communities. It's not just the firearms, it's the taser, it's everything else. It's the uniform. I'm really concerned about it. It doesn't look right. It doesn't look like community policing. But I absolutely have taken the Walpiri's counsel, and I am calling for there to be less firearms on police officers doing general duties in remote communities.
Do you think that would do a lot to foster trust between the black and white community in these places?
Yes, I do. I think it's an important thing that we need to consider looking at. We really do have a major issue here to deal with at the moment, and this may be a really important part of the healing process.
AM has sought a response from the Chief Minister, Michael Gunner.
Isabella Higgins reporting there. Just days after the alleged murder of teenager Kumanjai Walker, the small town of Carnarvon in Western Australia is preparing for the funeral of Yamatji woman Joyce Clark, shot dead by police in September. Amid calls for justice and protests around the country, locals are worried about the breakdown in trust between police and the Aboriginal community there too. Bridget Fitzgerald prepared this report.
24 hours ago, this main street into Carnarvon was virtually empty. Now carloads of people are streaming into town. Mourners are gathering here, some 900 kilometres north of Perth, for the funeral of Yamatji woman Joyce Clark, who died after she was shot by a police officer in Geraldton in September. But alongside family, friends and members of the Yamatji community will be dozens of police reinforcements from across the state.
They've filled this town with police. We've been here all our lives and we've never seen this many police in this town.
Les Cook is the CEO of the Carnarvon Aboriginal Medical Service, but he's also a close family friend who knew Joyce Clark as a child. He says the increase in police presence has been notable in the days leading up to the funeral.
They've been pulling young kids up, young boys, playing basketball in the park and searching them, stuff like that. That's just totally stupid, you know. They've just got to stand back, let the funeral happen, say their goodbyes to the family can say their goodbyes to the young girl, and hopefully that's it.
Because if the police are going to drive past the churches or the cemeteries, it's just going to be provocation.
AM has been told by sources close to Joyce Clark's family that feelings of mistrust in the police have only worsened since the death of Kumanjai Walker, shot by a Northern Territory police officer in the remote community of Yundamu on Saturday. Liz Cook again.
I don't know what you do about it. It's just too many young cops with the armoury on the hips. What do you do? The first thing they reach for is the most powerful weapon when they got this other stuff. It's just... And things are just escalating week by week because somebody's getting shot or somebody's dying in custody. It never ends.
In a statement, a spokeswoman for WA Police said the investigation into Joyce Clark's death is ongoing, but the police are working with the family and the broader community. The officer involved remains stood aside from operational duties. Bridget Fitzgerald in Carnarvon for AM.
When kids are placed in child protection, we'd all hope that everything possible is done to make sure they're safe and well supported. But a newly released report in Victoria shone a light on how the system failed 35 children. They took their own lives. Often, the department that was supposed to keep an eye on them shut the children's files, knowing they were in great danger. There are now calls for a federal response and a national strategy, as the commissioner who oversees child protection in Victoria says the problems stretch beyond state borders. Eleanor Whitehead has more.
The report tabled in Victoria's Parliament found that 35 children who died by suicide had been failed by child protection. They were all severely neglected, but most of their cases were either closed without action or passed on to other organisations who couldn't help them. Leanna Buchanan is the state's principal commissioner for children and young people.
I can tell you that when I've spoken to others in other parts of the country who work in the system, most of them are saying this is an issue that is not unique to Victoria. Part of the problem is we have a different approach to child protection. We have different laws in every state and territory. That's a real challenge in terms of trying to get improvement.
Her report made 6 recommendations, among them a call for more funding to reach vulnerable families with so-called early interventions.
I'd love to see this as the subject of a genuine collaborative response from states and the federal government. In Victoria, when we looked at the figures of the total child and family service budget, only a quarter is spent on early intervention. Clearly, there's a good reason to look at trying to intervene earlier. And to me, it makes sense to have a joined up approach to that and to have genuine commitment to improving children's lives from state and federal level.
Across Australia, suicide is the leading cause of death in children aged 5 to 17, with 100 cases recorded in 2018. The chief executive of family support organisation Anglicare Victoria, Paul McDonald, agrees a national response is needed.
The report has indicated that families that have repetitively hit the system are not getting the intervention that they require. And so what ends up is these families then go drifting and find themselves in a range of emergency services, whether it's the emergency department, whether it's the police station, or whether it's the homeless shelter. So to avoid higher downstream costs that inevitably end up on the desk of the federal government, they need to get more interested and more involved in working with the states.
Raylene Harradine is chair of the Victorian Aboriginal Children and Young People's Alliance. She's calling for urgent funding for early intervention and a bigger role for Aboriginal service providers.
I think Victoria are so far, we're a little bit advanced in terms of we've got an Aboriginal Commissioner for young people and children. I would love to see, ultimately, that we have a national Aboriginal Commissioner for children and young people.
Federal Minister for Families and Social Services, Anne Rustin, told AM that child protection is a matter predominantly for state and territory governments. But she said the Morrison government is helping facilitate discussions between all jurisdictions on the national framework for protecting Australia's children.
Eleanor Whitehead reporting there, and if you or anyone you know needs help, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. Unfair, cruel and discriminatory, they're the words that the Aged Care Royal Commission used to describe the policy of home care packages in its recently released interim report. Commissioners were alarmed to find that the waiting times for gaining approval for those plans and then the subsequent time it took to find the right services was so long that many people died while waiting for a package. Fixing that is one of the Commission's main recommendations. Isabel Rowe takes a look at the problem.
2 years ago, Rachel Lonergan's father, David, was struggling with Alzheimer's. After navigating the federal government's home care requirements, her family was told he'd need to be put on a lengthy waiting list for a level of care below what he needed.
We were told that it would take 12 to 18 months for a spot to become available. And given he had Alzheimer's, which was rapidly progressing, we felt that by the time that 12 to 18 months spot came up, he might be in a nursing home or he might already be dead.
David Lonergan couldn't wait and went into an aged care home. He died in June this year, aged 80, 7 months after going onto the home care waiting list.
He would never have had access to the home care package that we'd been offered.
The Royal Commission into Aged Care Quality and Safety found the Lonergan story is common. More than 16,000 people died waiting for their home care package in the 12 months to June 2018. In fact, more people were waiting for home care than were actually receiving it. It's a situation that frustrates service providers.
The waiting list is far too long, and it has been, and it's been growing.
Martin Warner is the chief executive of home care provider Home Instead. He says his organisation has no control over how long people wait if they come through the government system.
If someone came to us today and wanted private services, we could probably do it within 2 hours. When it comes to the government-funded clients, they've got to go through the whole assessment process and then they eventually get a letter from the government who will say, well, look, you've been assessed, you're eligible for a level 1, 2, 3 or 4 package we'll advise you when that will take place, when you can then receive that package.
The Royal Commission heard an increasing number of elderly Australians and their families want home care rather than a nursing home or residential facility. In a study to be released today by the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare, researchers have collected the first ever data on the use of health services in aged care. The Institute's Louise York says people in home care are less likely to be treated with antipsychotic medication, a key concern for the Royal Commission. She also says they have fewer accidents.
The data we have show that about 10% of people living in permanent residential aged care were admitted to hospital for a fall-related injury, compared to 6% of those receiving a home care package. To some extent, the data really just validate what a lot of other evidence is showing. And what we're hoping that is that by repeatedly updating data like this, we can look at change over time in response to reforms and other interventions.
The Royal Commission has made several interim recommendations to shorten waiting lists for at-home care, including funding more packages, converting some of the lower care packages to high care, and adding a further level, level 5, to allow people with very high care needs to stay at home longer. Prime Minister Scott Morrison has pledged he will boost spending on aged care and says he'll make the announcement in the December budget update.
Isabel Rowe. Two years after a campaign of brutal violence and mass rape forced 750,000 Rohingyas to flee Myanmar, refugee numbers in neighbouring Bangladesh have rocketed. Today, the country hosts around 1 million Rohingya, but compassion is turning into resentment as tensions simmer among locals. Background Briefing's Sarah Dingle travelled to Bangladesh with the East-West Centre for this story.
A short distance from the seaside resort of Cox's Bazar, we come to Kuttapalong in southeastern Bangladesh, the biggest refugee camp in the world. Hundreds of thousands of Rohingyas are crammed into just 13 square kilometres. And more than half of them are children.
This is a room with maybe 20, 25 children in it, and they all look about anywhere between 6 and 8. And they're all learning, as you can hear, to sing Itsy Bitsy Spider.
The Bangladeshi government doesn't allow these kids into state classrooms. They're also not permitted to learn the local language Bangla. This is a deliberate policy to keep them segregated from the host population. Instead, some Rohingya children have access to NGO-funded learning centres, where they get a few hours a day with an educator.
He's trying to say I'm learning the maths, Burmese.
And how long has he been coming to this centre?
2 months. Around 2 months.
In August 2017, a group of Rohingya insurgents in Myanmar attacked police posts. Myanmar's military retaliated and there was widespread violence. Former Australian Human Rights Commissioner Chris Sidoti says it was so vicious, the leaders of the military should be tried for genocide.
The strategies were consistent throughout this area. The conduct towards the people, the burning of the villages. Most worryingly, the scale of mass gang rape of multiple women that occurred in almost every village that was attacked by the military.
In Kuthapalong camp, 18-year-old Ajitha describes the violence of 2017.
We were raped. Our houses and villages were burned down.
The refugee camp is starting to grate with the locals from the nearby port city. There's plenty of flashpoints between Bangladeshis and Rohingya, and locals resent the free LPG gas given to Rohingya refugees for cooking. Local media is now reporting that Rohingyas are involved in crime. Now, Bangladesh says it's going to construct a barbed wire fence around the camps, complete with CCTV and watchtowers. Bangladesh's counter-terrorism police fear the situation could explode. Monirul Islam is a police commissioner in Dhaka.
When these under 14 children will be 18 plus, then it will be a real threat for us. Then we think that at least a significant number of them will be radicalised.
That's Police Commissioner Monirul Islam ending Sarah Dingle's report. And you can hear Sarah's full investigation on Background Briefing this Sunday on Radio National, or you can podcast it now. The World Anti-Doping Agency's appeal against the Chinese swimmer Sun Yang begins in Switzerland tonight in a case that has huge ramifications for drug testing in sport. Sun was cleared of an anti-doping violation after refusing a urine test and smashing a blood vial with a hammer when testers visited his home in China last year. He successfully claimed the testers didn't have the proper accreditation. The appeal is seen as a test case on the rights of athletes against doping officials. Here's our national sport reporter, David Mark.
And Sun it is who takes the first of the gold medals. Horton takes the silver.
It's a case that's being watched around the world. Sun Yang is a superstar in China, an Olympic gold medalist and a world record holder. But his record is tarnished by a positive doping test in 2014. He was banned for 3 months. And when this July's Swimming World Championships rolled around, Australia's Mac Horton refused to share a podium with Sun, even though he'd been acquitted of last year's doping infraction.
Horton did not stand up on the medal podium, and he's still not standing up.
Sun's critics regard him as an abrasive character, and the swimming world has largely come out against him. But the former Canadian Olympic swimmer and lawyer, Nikki Dryden, says it's important to separate the man from the issue.
The last person on earth I really want to be supporting is Sun Yang. You know, he's not my favourite athlete, but at the same time, I want to make sure that the next athlete who comes into the system and is being held to a strict liability level, that the authorities are held to the same standard.
Last year, Sun successfully argued that the testers didn't have the proper accreditation when they came to his house late one night in September, and it's expected he'll mount the same argument again. Nikki Dryden says WADA will focus on the urine sample he refused to give and the fact he ordered a security guard to smash the vial containing his blood sample.
No matter what, you provide a sample. Sun Yang didn't provide a sample, and therefore that is the issue that they're going to focus on.
The lecturer in sports law at the University of Canberra, Dr. Catherine Ordway, says the stakes are high for Sun.
Worst case scenario, he could be looking at a life ban. So this is very serious, which is why you can feel some empathy for Sun Yang in this case, because he understands the implications.
Both Nikki Dryden and Dr. Ordway believe Sun is likely to win the appeal.
But it's unlikely to be an outcome that the World Anti-Doping Agency is going to be happy with.
The former Olympic swimmer, Nikki Dryden, is taking a broad view.
If Sun Yang wins his case, that will be great for all athletes. Swimmers are going to be upset. I don't know. I just wish that people were understanding the underlying issue here, which is that this is about the athlete right in the doping process. This is not about Sun Yang personally.
The case will be heard at the Court of Arbitration for Sport in Switzerland tonight. The result isn't expected to be known for some time, but if Sun is successful, it could rebalance the playing field in world sport.
That's National Sport reporter David Mark. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Ruby Jones.
And I'm Chris Dengate, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. Last weekend, a 19-year-old man was shot dead in the remote Northern Territory community of Yuendamu.
A 28-year-old Northern Territory police officer has now been charged with murder. He's been bailed and suspended on full pay.
Today on The Signal, we look into the death of Kumanjai Walker.
Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.